Chapter 6 The Great Stink. After Edward Jenner, no one in history did more to promote the vaccine enterprise than the French chemist and microbiologist Louis Pasteur. A brilliant, charismatic man of great talent and industry, Pasteur made significant contributions to our understanding of infectious disease microbes and the true cause of fermentation. His technique for heating beverages to a high temperature to eliminate pathogens was later named pasteurization in his honor. Despite these other achievements, he remains best known and celebrated for his attenuated rabies vaccine, which we will evaluate in the next chapter. Here we note that his choice to tackle rabies was peculiar in that, as dreadful as the disease is, it typically killed less than 50 people per year in France, while typhoid, cholera, and tuberculosis killed tens of thousands. After completing his doctorate in chemistry and physics in 1847, Pasteur became a professor at the University of Strasbourg in 1848. There he met his wife, Marie Laurent, the daughter of the university's rector. They were married in 1849 and had five children. Jeanne, their eldest daughter, was born in 1850 and died of typhoid fever when she was 9 years old. 7 years later, their daughter, Cécile, also died of typhoid fever in 1866 when she was 12 years old. Neither Pasteur nor anyone else understood the causative agent of typhoid until Carl Joseph Ebert discovered and characterized the Salmonella typhi bacterium in 1879 and deduced it was spread primarily through water. Even more deadly than typhoid was cholera. Between 1816 and 1923, with increasing commerce with India, cholera repeatedly struck Europe. While Robert Koch is frequently credited with discovering the causative agent in 1883, in fact, the Italian anatomist Filippo Pacini discovered a comma-shaped bacillus during an outbreak in Florence in 1854. In that same year, he published a paper entitled Microscopical Observations and Pathological Deductions on Cholera, in which he characterized the organism and called it Vibrio, from the Latin word meaning quiver. In his paper, he correctly hypothesized that the microorganism impaired intestinal mucosa reabsorption, thereby causing debilitating diarrhea, vomiting, severe dehydration, and death. Pacini's paper received little attention from the medical community, apparently because it questioned the prevailing miasma theory, that is, that the disease was transmitted by poisonous vapors in the air. In that same year, a cholera outbreak in London's crowded Soho district killed about 500 people in 10 days. Dr. John Snow, founder of the Epidemiological Society of London in 1850, produced a geographical grid to plot the location of each death and to determine the victim's water source. This enabled him to identify the Broad Street pump in Soho as the outbreak's source. Snow suspected the causative agent was waterborne and not spread by foul-smelling miasma, but he was unable to isolate and identify the causative agent. Like Pacini's paper, Dr. Snow's observations were therefore initially dismissed by the medical establishment. It was only when Robert Koch isolated the Vibrio bacillus in pure culture in 1883 and weighed in with his eminent authority that the medical establishment finally recognized that Pacini and Snow had been correct. Looking back on the 19th century, it now seems strange how slow the medical profession was to recognize that contaminated drinking water was the cause of diseases such as typhoid and cholera. All over Europe, medical doctors stuck with their miasma theory of infectious disease for years after Pacini and Snow did their landmark studies. The orthodox view was that Europe's cities were disease-ridden because they were full of foul vapors. In other words, according to the prevailing logic, the poor districts and the poor people who inhabited them were frequently ill because they stank. As the German novelist Patrick Süskind memorably described this stench in his novel, Perfume, "In the period in which we speak, there reigned in the cities a stench barely conceivable to us, modern men and women. The streets stank of manure, the courtyards of urine, the stairwells stank of moldering wood and rat droppings, the kitchens of spoiled cabbage and mutton fat. The unaired parlors stank of stale dust, the bedrooms of greasy sheets, damp feather beds, and the pungently sweet aroma of chamber pots. The stench of sulfur rose from the chimneys, the stench of caustic lies from the tanneries, and from the slaughterhouse came the stench of congealed blood. People stank of sweat and unwashed clothes. From their mouths came the stench of rotting teeth." Amid all this squalor that grew steadily more noxious until well past the middle of the 19th century, the medical profession exerted little effort to encourage municipal authorities to clean up the things that stank. The most obvious problem was the gross contamination of rivers, often the same rivers that supplied drinking water, with raw sewage. In Britain, the first notable person to propose building a proper sewage system was the painter John Martin, who published beautiful, detailed plans for London in the 1830s. Another noteworthy advocate for public sanitation during this period was the English lawyer and social reformer Edwin Chadwick. In 1838, while working for the Royal Commission to alleviate poverty, he launched an inquiry into the causes of a recent typhus outbreak. For the first time in British history, a government official commissioned medical doctors to investigate the conditions that could contribute to ill health. One of the investigators, Dr. Dyce Guthrie, became convinced that one of the greatest causes of disease was the lack of clean water and proper effluent drainage. Chadwick's report on the findings of his inquiry ultimately led to the passage of the Public Health Act of 1848, with provisions for improving public sanitation. It was a good legislative start, but the pace of building sanitation infrastructure was slow. A major impetus arrived with a heat wave in 1858. During the hottest summer on record, air temperature in the shade in London hovered around 95 degrees Fahrenheit and rose to 118 degrees in the sun. The combination of heat and diminished river flow turned the Thames into what came to be known as the Great Stink. A cover story in the city press declared, "Gentility of speech is at an end. It stinks, and whoso once inhales the stink can never forget it, and can count himself lucky if he lives to remember it." Parliament was filled with such an abominable stench that the legislative body considered moving to Oxford or St. Albans. House of Commons leader Benjamin Disraeli declared on June 15th that the Thames was a Stygian pool reeking with ineffable and intolerable horrors. A debate ensued about who in the government was responsible for the wretched state of the river. On June 15th, Punch, satirical magazine, joked, "The one absorbing topic in both Houses of Parliament was the conspiracy to poison question. Of the guilt of that old offender, Father Thames, there was the most ample evidence." Enough was enough. Something big needed to be done to clean up the Thames, no matter what it cost. As the Times put it, Parliament was all but compelled to legislate upon the great London nuisance by the force of sheer stench. A bill was passed to allocate £3 million to build a proper sewer system. Sir Joseph Bazalgette, a gifted civil engineer, was given the task of designing and executing the enormous project of bewildering complexity. His plan, which borrowed many of the painter John Martin's ideas, envisaged a network of 82 miles of enclosed, underground brick main sewers to receive outflows, and 1,100 miles of tributary sewers to divert effluent from the streets of London to the river downstream of the city. For almost 20 years, Basil Jett oversaw the construction with little rest. His records of the construction, replete with his sketches and handwritten notes, amount to thousands of pages. The first phase of the project was opened in 1865, and the rest was completed in 1875. At the time construction began, most doctors and public health officials believed the sewer would reduce cholera by eliminating the foul miasma that contaminated the city's air. But the true value of the sewer was that it contained and channeled the city's effluent away from its water supply. This reality only became widely understood at about the time the construction was completed in 1884, the same year in which Robert Koch published his paper on isolating the Vibrio cholerae bacteria in pure culture, vindicating the findings of Filippo Pacini and John Snow 30 years earlier. Unfortunately for the people of Hamburg, Germany, located just 180 miles from Koch's lab in Berlin, the city's parsimonious municipal leaders did not follow London's example until after the city was struck with a devastating cholera outbreak in 1892, which killed 8,594 people. Sir Joseph Basil Jett's sewer is an engineering wonder that reduced cholera and typhoid in London to a few occasional cases. The tireless efforts of this dedicated civil engineer probably saved tens of thousands of lives in the decades that followed. And yet, most Londoners today have probably never heard of him. A modest memorial on the Victoria Embankment reminds passers-by of the immense service he rendered for the health of millions.